Hello and welcome to the Classic Car Weekly podcast, the sibling show to the popular weekly paper. I'm the staff writer, Jesse Billington, and this week I'm joined by our editor, David Simister.
Good morning, how are you doing?
Not too bad. And our managing editor, James Sadlier.
And greetings from me. How are you both?
Yeah, pretty good, Dave.
Absolutely good, good.
Yeah. And more importantly, we'll start as we often do with our classics. How are they?
Fairly quiet for me on the Mazda front. I'm looking for an opportunity. I need a free weekend where it's a bit quieter, a bit sunnier, so I can get out and give it a damn good clean. But the weather's been horrendous here lately.
It's not been great here either.
Yeah, that I must say, it doesn't take long before in this kind of weather for the cars to look really mucky.
I could really do with a garage again.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. I've had a little bit of drama with the Polo, and this will be featuring in a future Classic Car Weekly Hour Classics. As you guys both know, my exhaust has always looked like it's kind of running a little bit low on the Polo. I've got a 1992 Volkswagen Polo bred van, and it's always looked a bit low. And anyway, I was coming in to my road where I live, and suddenly I heard a clang and the scraping of metal along the ground. I looked out my rearview mirror, and as I say to Jesse the other day, there were Formula One style sparks coming from the back, which kind of looked cool, but obviously isn't fun for a few seconds. So luckily, I just kind of limped it onto the driveway, and it was, the back of the exhaust was falling off. So I showed David this, and I managed to kind of tie the exhaust back up using some straps that I could kind of tie up into the boot. And I managed to get it over to the garage. And what happened was a few of the rubber bungees, I think they're referred to, rubber links, kind of just worn out, really. So the exhaust was fine. And at the same time, I gave it a good, healthy service.
Very nice. Quite on the front from me. I've got the dashboard finally out of the Jimny, so working to the root of the heater matrix problems. The amount of water that I've drained from the driver's footwell has been substantial. So that is all of the coolant out of the engine through the carpet in the driver's footwell. It's a relatively straightforward job on that, because thankfully Suzuki sort of built the dashboard around its sort of central metal spar and then just bolted the spar in. So in reality, it only takes a few bolts to undo it. It's then just a case of undoing all of the wiring loom clips underneath. And I'm sort of so used to working on the MG, which has maybe four electrical components. Doing it on the Jimny was a bit more fiddly. And again, I'm 6'1". I'm considerably taller than the average Japanese mechanic. So trying to get to all of the bits under the dashboard involved mostly sort of sitting on the seat facing the wrong way with my head under the dashboard, my feet pretty much on the ceiling. A bit of contortion to get the job done, but it's all out. The dashboard is now currently resting on the front end of the midget. And I'm now without any working cars. But hey, we're steps in the right direction.
And the swear jar in your garage is a little fuller as well.
Yeah, it took a hell of a lot of swearing to get it out. The incredibly fiddly little clips with all sorts of... Each clip for the wiring loom is different, not just in its shape and its, but the connection and the way that it locks together. Each one is different. So every time you get to one, you go, oh, this will just be simply press and then pull apart. But no, this one is sort of release two clicks at the side of it and then sort of twist and pull. Or this one, you have to undo an entire lever along the top of it, like some sort of mousetrap, and then press something and then pull it apart. And like, why couldn't they have just used all the same? But it does at least mean they'll all go back together relatively straightforward, because they're all incredibly individual. So it's sort of swings and roundabouts. Hopefully it won't take too long to put it all back together. But it's work in progress.
So we'll be walking to the office next week then?
Thankfully, I do have loan of my mother's old Vauxhall Astra. So I'm not entirely without wheels. But really depends on how soon I can get hold of a new matrix for the Jimny as to whether or not that comes back together. I could end up with the MG rebuilt before the Jimny is, but we'll wait and see how that pans out.
Fingers crossed.
One of them will get fixed before spring, hopefully both of them. Yeah. Anyway, that's not what we're here to talk about. We'll tuck into the meat of this week's issue, and I've been gallivanting around Europe. If you turn to pages 4 and 5 of this week's paper, there's my report from Interclassics at the MECC in Maastricht. And what's in the paper, there's some great stories in there, but that's sort of not half of what I found while I was there. It was actually quite a lot. As soon as you started scratching away, you found quite a lot of interesting cars, and a few of them include a lovely undriven Lancia A112 Junior, tiny little sort of odd Lancia hatchback they built during the sort of, I think it was the 80s. And I spoke with the dealer that was selling it, and this car had been shipped off to its dealership originally and then simply never collected. And it was just sort of floated around on the dealership network around Europe for quite a while until a collector bought it. And he then sold it because he didn't want to drive it because it only had 399 kilometers on the clock. So it was sold on again. And there's even still the original sort of end of production line paperwork taped into the windscreen. Yours for €17,500, but odd little thing, but quite endearing.
Oh, I liked your, in the same report, your Porsche prototype that broke cover, which also had a quite a high asking price of €394,000, but it was so rare, and with only 11 made, I can understand why. But it's a great chance to own a very unique piece of history, and it's been sat in America, obviously, where the weather's lovely, and sat dormant since 2007 with a full history. So yeah, it does look lovely.
Yeah, sort of sat on the western side of the Rockies, so it was all sort of nice and dry and salt-free. And again, that had sort of been, they sort of had used it as a production mule, tested a bunch of different bits out for the ahead of the American market receiving the 911 and the 912. And then sort of, as Porsche sort of had a habit of doing, just sort of got to the end of needing the car for prototype development and went, should we just get rid of that one? They're like, yeah, sure. So they just sort of sold it to someone within the factory, was sort of how the car seemed to escape. And then the car got sold on to someone else. I think it was an American soldier that was over in Europe. And then obviously they brought it back to America. And then it ended up in America, deteriorated a bit, sat in the barn, and then was restored in the early noughties. And yeah, has come back onto sort of the Porsche Europe scene. And despite achieving something like a ridiculous sort of high 600 out of 600 and something out of 700 points on a concourse, only scored a silver. Like, what do you need to score gold in that concourse competition if 690 something is a silver? I'm like, how strong is the competition? What are they looking for detail wise? So, wow. Yeah, it was a really, really interesting car to sort of look around at. I think not necessarily visually, it's relatively straightforward. It's a 1960s Porsche, but it's the history that it has with it is, again, one of the fascinating things behind it.
With I went to the Interclassics in Brussels, which is the sister show of the one that you went to in Maastricht. And I found it was a really great show. It seemed to be that they had really focused on the buying and selling of cars, or certainly in this case the selling of cars, to the point where a lot of the dealers were having to bring in more cars because they were selling them off their stands at the weekend. And it was quite unexpected. Did you feel like you saw that at the Maastricht show?
There was a bit of that at Maastricht as well. There was definitely cars trading hands, because obviously I went in on the Thursday and sort of had a good look around and sort of saw what was there, what was floating about. And there was a couple of sort of stands that had cars on it. And then I came back in on the Friday morning just to mop up a few more bits. And I was like, oh, that's changed. That's changed. That's different. That's new. And yeah, there was, cars were selling on the Thursday. And Thursday was the quieter of the days. They had a record number of people through the door, something over 40,000, I think, off the top of my head. Yeah. So it proved to be a very popular show. And I think the market is still thriving, and it's certainly commanding some strong prices. There was a rather tidy Morgan, I think it was a +4, that was on a dealership stand, and it had sort of a price that, even once you're taking into account exchange rates, was sort of significantly above the going rate for a similar condition UK Morgan. So there's strong prices, but again, it's they're struggling to find sort of buyers at the moment for 50s, 60s cars, even into the early 70s as well. 80s, 90s is, much like we're seeing in the UK, proving to be the hot selling point. But competition cars, rare, unique cars from any iteration, are still sort of proving popular, because that's what they'll do. They're rare and unique cars. They'll still sort of have those buyers.
It certainly sounds like there's quite a real swathe of kind of interesting and rare cars, and particularly from the dealers taking part. I mean, how would you find that it's different? You've obviously been, Jesse, to the our sort of flagship show, the big one at the NEC in November, and a couple of the bigger shows around the country. How would you say Interclassics differs from if you wanted to, if you're in the UK and you wanted to head over there? I mean, what kind of things would you expect if you headed over from Blighty?
This was very dealer led, so you don't go along expecting sort of big sort of stands celebrating histories of models and sort of a lot of club stands. It's a lot more, I want to say industry focused is the wrong phrase to use, but it's a lot more sort of showcasey, please buy our cars. So if you want to learn more about the cars, you do end up having to get talking to people, but English is predominantly the second language for huge amounts of Netherlands, and everyone I spoke to was absolutely lovely. So it's an easy show to get along to, get talking to people, find out things. I think that's the reason why I sort of came away with far more than I'd anticipated, sort of story and car and fact and history wise. The IndyCar that features in the coverage, the 1934 model, I was sort of chatting away with one of the guys over at Gallery Aldering about sort of the car, and then sort of out of nowhere the chap who was selling the car just sort of rocks up and sort of joins the conversation. So it was great to sort of get the chance to hear from him. So incredibly friendly, incredibly open. It's sort of very relaxed atmosphere, but yeah, the way that it's set up is not the same as you'd expect at the Resto show or the NEC, the Classic Motor Show in November. It's a little more sort of functional when it comes to sort of the idea that is you're going along to buy cars, but you can still go along and have a look and sort of find these fantastic models you wouldn't otherwise see. There was a 1 of 5 Bugatti that was on display, a 1925 T23 Brescia, on offer for €390,000. One of five produced, only three of which remain, and this one was UK registered as well and had enjoyed a complete rebody and a lot of mechanical work in the 50s. So if you really into your odd sort of 20s and 30s sports cars, the cars are out there that you could easily spend a lot more time than I had sort of poring around it. And there are a few club stands. I think the Citroen 2CV, the club were there. There was a couple of other sort of smaller European clubs, a couple of European magazines were there. So there's plenty to sort of look around and enjoy and get talking to. But yeah, it's atmosphere wise, it's just the same. There's a lot of chatter, a lot of people sort of milling around looking, having these conversations. But also, I don't want to say this sounding critically, but it is incredibly affordable as well compared to how you'd anticipate sort of other shows in the UK. Certainly I think my lunch inside the show hall cost under perhaps £10, and tickets for 4 days were somewhere in the region of about £30. So,
and how did you get there, and how long did it take?
Getting there and back was train. I got up at 3:40 in the morning, caught a bus across London, and got the first Eurostar out of St Pancras. There are better ways of doing it. Obviously, you could go out the day before. But for sort of time and production wise, I sort of shoveled it all into sort of one quite literally 24-hour package. So yeah, first train out from London to Brussels, and then changed on to sort of trains Brussels to Liège, Liège to Maastricht. Relatively straightforward on the train. The only hiccup we had was on the way back on the Friday, get to Maastricht station, only to find that the train I'm supposed to be getting on is broken down. So it is a quick hop in an Uber and a race to Liège to hopefully get my connecting train Liège to Brussels, and then Brussels back to London again. So yeah, flat out, but yeah, easy enough to do. And if you're not doing it on the same time pinch, it's reasonable.
Oh, new news just in.
I was about to say, going back to the cars though that you saw on the show, and being the higher priced ones, one of the things that all the dealers would say is that the best examples of the cars will always sell. I mean, obviously there's going to be a cut off with regard to, you know, certain values if they're really overpriced, but the best cars will always sell, even the unique prototypes. Sorry, yeah. David, you were about to say news just in.
Yeah, I was going to say news just in from Jesse, trains break down on the continent too.
Oh, yeah.
They're at least a bit more honest about it and sort of have other trains running at the time. I think that was the only sort of public transport based hiccup. Even getting in and out from the hotel to the center of Maastricht was pretty straightforward, just tap on, tap off bus. I had outside of the show, obviously, a lovely hotel room booked by Ed Assistance at CCW. Dinner in the city centre and lovely little cafe local, very European style, end up sat outside while waiting for my table to come free. So sat outside under a heat lamp with a blanket wrapped around my legs and a lovely local beer to enjoy. And then, stoof lease inside, and then back up to the hotel to do a bit of photo editing and writing, and then back in the show the next morning. So it's a nice way to sort of enjoy a very European atmosphere. But yeah, trains, if you don't try and do it all within sort of 36 hours and allow yourself a bit more flexibility than we had, it is reasonable to do. And I think it was just I had to literally be there for show opening on Thursday and then be back in London for a dinner on Friday evening. I sort of had a very tight turnaround to get in and out and do everything that I needed to do. But yeah.
Now, the joys of weekly newspapers. The great thing is, as you say, if you do have a little bit more free time, it's a great way of seeing classics that you wouldn't necessarily see in the UK. And it's surprisingly affordable to do as well, especially if you're booking in advance. Jesse, you put together the event listings in Classic Car Week. What sort of shows, if anyone listening to this thing, I could do with actually a cheap winter break, looking at some classic cars. What else is coming up on the horizon that enthusiasts can go to?
Wow, immediately coming up, Retromobile in Paris is
on. You're going to, aren't you, James?
Looking forward to it. So not this weekend after next, weekend of February.
Yeah.
I think
the opening day is the 6th. I think, is it the 5th or 6th? I think it is.
Week today. Yeah, week today on the day of recording. I think I've got a calendar floating around somewhere over here that I could confirm that. 5th would be the Wednesday. So yeah, they'll probably open with like a press day on the Wednesday. But yeah, that's always worth looking forward to. Techno Classica, which is Essen off the top of my head.
That's
another popular one to headlong to.
End of March, I think, off the top of my head. That's another good one to do. And Stuttgart as well. I mean, we're planning on heading up to that later in the spring as well. I think Hope our features is going to that one. And again, that's a great one for, in particular if you're flying in, because the show hall is right next to Stuttgart Airport. So you can just literally hop off the plane, pick up your bags and walk straight into the show.
Yeah, I mean, that was what I enjoyed with Maastricht, was once I got off the train at the Maastricht station, it was 2-minute walk to the hotel and the MECC. So the same as if you're staying at a hotel at the MEC in Birmingham, it's sort of like getting off the train at Birmingham International. You're sort of, everything is right there immediately. But price wise, sort of about a third of the price. So it's worth doing, and tie in doing a little bit of the local culture while you're there, make it a really nice sort of European vacation. Just sort of pretty good. I mean, there's other great cars there. There was Jochen Mass's 1976 DRM Ford Capri RS 2600. So that had also just received an incredible restoration and, again, up for grabs. I mean, the amount of cars that were on offer was sublime. You could lose yourself in it. And even their display celebrating 30 years of the show, the lead image on the spread 4-5 showcases some of the slightly more sort of diverse range of cars that are there, including a very nice Veritas 315. But there was also Nigel Mansell's Lotus 87 and Eleanor Mustang and a Silver Cloud 2 drophead coupe, as well as a BMW 507. So really unique collection that had been publicly voted for to celebrate all the different sort of milestones the show had seen come and go, and sort of people picking out the cars that had really matched up to what sort of had been highlights of their shows. So it was nice to have that public engagement with it, and then all put together in this really nice sort of showcase of cars with the Ferrari 250 sat in the middle of it. But yeah, it was a nice show to do. First time doing one of the European shows, and doing it solo was a bit of an experience, but well worth the joys of doing, especially if you're a fan of Dutch and Belgian beers, certainly. So that's one to bear in mind if that's where you're heading. Great time. And there will be more content on this coming out. I've got some video bits I want to put together. There's plenty more pictures that will be appearing on the socials too. So keep an eye across the social media platforms. We've got some more bits and pieces to carry on the Inter Classics coverage. We'll dip into the second sort of the main story from the news section this week, which is 3D printing parts for classics.
Yeah, so this was another one that came out of Club Expo. So anyone who picked up last week's issue will have seen a couple of stories about the DVLA making some encouraging noises about how they're going to be looking at classics in the future. And we talked about the Federation of British Historic Vehicle Clubs there, a big national survey. So obviously those are some of the big stories that we've already covered. But this was another story, and this is one of their new partners. This is a company called IGUS, who very big operation based in Germany, and they've got their UK headquarters over in Northampton. And their product manager is a chap called Alan Hicks, was talking about the fact that they can make pretty much anything at any quantity they want, which what they were pointing out to clubs is if you've got a part that previously may have been too prohibitively expensive to order a spare product, spares production run, you can go along, you can get all your measurements for it, you can plot them all into their website, hit the order button, and even if you only need one, they can make it for you. They can make it in plastic, they can make it in steel. It's it's a fantastic opportunity potentially for clubs. And the thing that the Federation of the FBHVC were pointing out is that this potentially is a huge opportunity for clubs, because it means that they can make parts for cars that previously would have just been a definite no for them because of the costs involved. So I think it's a really good opportunity for enthusiasts to put older cars back on the road, and it's prices that probably would not have been affordable previously, and that just shows you how much 3D printing has advanced over the last 10 years or so.
Yeah, my understanding of it previous to this was, things like the plastics, like I'm looking for some wing mirrors for my Polo, but I don't want aftermarket, I want actual kind of Volkswagen side mirrors, which are quite hard to find. But my understanding of this now is it could be any type of part, from any type of metal or alloy or whatever. And presumably you have to know all the dimensions yourself, or is that something
out? Yeah, as long as you have an original or the diagrams to work from, so you got the measurements. So obviously they can. They talked about how thick flanges are on the end of things, and as long as you have those measurements, all you need to do is plot them in, and they will go away and they will make them for you. We're using their motion plastic technology, so it's quite interesting. But certainly, it's fascinating to see how this technology, I remember we first started covering it in CTG about 12, 13 years ago, and I remember at the time it was like something out of tomorrow's world. It was seen as being fantastically expensive technology, which could only be used for sort of people with Aston Martins and very high-end race cars and so on. And now you can actually buy 3D printers now for about £400 or £500, and it's now got to the level where clubs are either able to sort of order these parts fairly easily from specialists, or they really wanted to, they could buy their own 3D printers and just run off a few parts themselves. And certainly it's not unprecedented. I mean, the Triumph Stag Owners Club, they used it last year to create the bowls for the door handles on cars. And again, previously that would have cost them an absolute fortune to get them remade, but now using 3D printing, they can actually do that a lot more affordably.
I was going to say, I know a lot of classics suffer from, when I'm writing sort of buying guides and pieces, it's easy to sort of say, oh, you can get the mechanical parts for this from here. People do sort of remanufactured sort of dampers from here. You can get gearboxes from here. And then it goes, interior, best of luck finding trim. So this is sort of a great step forward when it comes to sort of keeping these cars on the road in certainly an original form as well. It's sort of great for preservation of originality of car design without having to sort of just sort of hodgepodge bits together, or simply sort of also break apart otherwise usable cars simply to gather parts. So it's great when it comes to sort of preservation of not just one individual car but others within the same sort of family group, which is quite nice. I don't think the MG needs any bits, but I certainly need some sort of trim clips and plastic pieces for the Jimny, so I'll see if I can dig out some CAD CAM files for those and hit them up and see if I can get a few bits and pieces printed out. But it's a really useful step forward, and again, it's this sort of great coalescence of sort of incredibly modern technology and great heritage engineering and trying to preserve these fantastic bits of history.
One thing I was going to ask, say for example you know you need a part but you haven't got the blueprints, you haven't got the diagrams or the measurements, I'm sure most of the time they're available, if you haven't, could you go to them and say, look, for example, if I took the wing mirror off my car, which is, got a couple of cracks in it, could you bring that to the company, David, and then say, look, I don't have the measurements, but I do have an example. Can you replicate this?
Yeah, as far as I know, I mean, certainly the presentation they gave did give indications. I'm sure, obviously, if you went to IGUS and they've got pretty helpful customer service from what I gather as well, they would be able to kind of talk you through what they can and can't do. And it was certainly the impression I got from that presentation, the reaction from clubs, is actually it was quite surprising what they could do with various components. So it'd be interesting to see what they do. And again, if you haven't necessarily got the original part of the components yourselves, the best thing I would suggest is to talk to the clubs. I mean, one of the other big topics that are being talked about at Club Expo was about, you know, getting hold of original archives, and you know, that includes things like technical drawings. So, you know, things like, you know, getting you know, the original diagrams and the blueprints and so on. That's where you're going to find all that, you know, information.
I want them to build me a brand new Escort XR3i.
Bring them all the technical specifications. Yeah, for them. You simply have one 3D printed for
you. If they've got a big enough 3D printer, they might, you never know, in a few years' time, they might be able to print you a fully 3D print you a fully working Escort XR3i.
It's going to happen one day. I don't think anytime soon, but I can imagine someone doing that.
The technology is going that way. If you look at sort of modern hypercars, sort of the really sort of low production numbers, the way they're sort of revolutionizing the engineering behind them, sort of when it comes to 3D printing and casting parts, as well as sort of the re-engineering of parts that would otherwise sort of be traditionally designed, taking into account the unique sort of, it's a weird sort of crossover between sort of engineering and biology, looking at sort of the way the natural structures form their strength and then incorporating that in to actually produce a better, lighter component that uses less material but produces just the same amount of strength. So it's a great chance, certainly when it comes to sort of classic motorsports, to go, well, I've improved the wishbones and anti-roll bars on my Ford Falcon, but I've used like 70% of the material, so it weighs a lot less, and it's a great competitive edge. So yeah, it'd be interesting to see how this develops, but it's a great use of the technology. And when it comes to, sort of, again, this idea of sort of preservation and combining modern science and technology with my sort of love for old cars, this is exactly sort of right up my street. And I really enjoyed doing a bit of CAD/CAM work when I was at school in the design department, doing DT and sort of putting things together on sort of the computer, and then we'd have like a milling machine that would sort of mill it out for a block of plastic or wood, and you're sort of left with your product at the end. It's sort of the opposite of 3D printing. You sort of start with your material and strip it away, as opposed to add a material to create your product. But
yeah, it reminds me of a very interesting conversation I had many years ago at a show with a Jaguar enthusiast, and we were talking specifically about the Jaguar Mark 10, which I've always thought is a fabulous car, really underrated. And yeah, we were talking about the fact that Jaguar Mark 10s always seem to fetch less than Jaguar Mark 2s of the same era. And I said to him, well, why? Because, you know, it's a fabulous looking car, and you literally are getting more metal for your money. And he said the reason why they tend to sell for less is because it's harder to get bits for them. And maybe this, yeah, these advances in making parts more easily might actually move the dial a little bit. And you never know, it could make those, you know, those really lovely bigger Jaguars, which are much rarer these days, more desirable and more palatable for enthusiasts as a result.
Yeah, at the lower end, I really struggled at the lower end of the price bracket. I really struggled for the Peugeot 406 Coupe that I had to try and find certain parts. They're just such a lack of availability. But, you know, being able to 3D print a new bumper or something like that would have been superb.
It's a great opening up of new avenues for resurrecting classics. We'll take a quick look at the lead in this week's, which is motoring abroad. So we've sort of compiled some great tips and tricks when it comes to taking your classic abroad. And obviously we've included in that sort of some of the great driving options across Europe. But I wanted to sort of put to you guys, if you've got any sort of fun stories when things have either gone incredibly right or sometimes incredibly wrong when motoring abroad with either your classics or just in general.
You don't want to know my story.
Is it one that we could broadcast?
Possibly. It involves my Mazda MX-5 and a leaking air conditioning unit and how I fixed it.
Go on. How did you fix it?
It occurred to us that the footwell was full of water and very hot day, and the it was coming in via, you know, a pipe basically that was loose in the, you know, if you reached right up into the passenger footwell, and we couldn't think of any logical way of mending it. And I don't know how to put this, we mended it using a contraceptive.
It worked
perfectly, and we got you know, we had a completely dry run around the Nürburgring afterwards. But
thankfully you had something spare.
Well, yeah, I was going to say that was how we got this car mended. So there you go. That's my my MX-5 bodging in a German service station story. It gets more wrong by the minute.
If it works, it works.
I was going to say, sometimes you just need to get the car on the road.
It did the trick.
Yeah. I've got a few stories that are less risque, but that probably is like one of the best stories I've heard. And yeah, brilliant. If it got it back on the road, brilliant.
I know when
I've gone to Classic Le Mans before, and I'm sure you guys have seen this when I've gone to on the ferry with all the other British classics that go to Classic Le Mans every couple of years. I sort of love seeing the cars come on and off the ferry, but one of my favourites, well, it wasn't actually, it was a bit of a kind of, oh, I had to kind of grit my teeth, as a Ferrari F40 getting off a ferry. And as you know, those ramps aren't, they're not very forgiving with regards to the angles. And the last thing you want to hear is a Ferrari F40's kind of like body scraping along the ground as it comes off. Oh, it's, that car especially, you know, any car's not good, but... I've got two other stories. One interesting story of fun where we took a 1980s three series BMW to Villa d'Este and we were driving along and it turned into night. We knew we were in Italy somewhere, but we couldn't see. It was completely pitch black. Couldn't see a thing. And then suddenly there was a few bolts of lightning, and those bolts of lighting showed you a silhouette of the Alps. And it was, what a view, you know, and it's sheets of lightning for half an hour, just kind of showing these. And that was just such an amazing drive from the UK to you know, Lake Como. But my last story is taking a DAF over to Holland, and it wasn't a very healthy DAF. I think it was DAF 55, I think. Anyway, it had all these problems and various other kind of electrical problems. And we were about to get, we missed the ferry over to Holland, and we were close to missing it on the way back as well. And the only way to, we had to keep the car running from a lot of the time, because when we did cut off power to the engine and it wouldn't start, every time we had to get it to start, we had to unscrew some of the bulbs in the rear lights, stop power going to the lights to produce enough power to get the engine started. So can you imagine, you know, you see the ferry in the background and you can see it's about to leave, and you're frantically trying to take off these, you know, kind of light clusters and to try and take the bulb out, start the engine, screw the bulb back in, and then get the car going just so you can make the ferry.
I had a great story of not so much, you know, missing a ferry, but when we were already on it. This was a couple of years ago. We were on our way back from Le Mans, and we were in a W140 jet. It was a Mercedes S-Class, which some of you might remember we snapped up for £500, and we found out on that journey why it was £500, which is that upon disembarking from the ferry in Portsmouth, we found that this particular Mercedes would not start. Wouldn't start up, start motor wouldn't even go. And it turned out that the something in the car's brain had completely immobilized it. It was just refusing to even want to fire. So we were on this ferry and we could not get this car, you know, even to start, let alone, you know, drive back to our offices in Peterborough. And we ended up with 300, you know, French and British tourists behind us. They all had to drive around us, you know, sort of giving us evils as they drove past, because we'd blocked their route out, their route home. And P&O were very good, and they brought a big bulldozer, if you like, which kind of pulled us off the ferry into the port. And then we then had to get the AA to come out to us, who had to go through passport control to get to us. So we had an AA man with a passport with us. And as he was going through, trying to look through every electrical Mercedes start code known to man, a transit van pulls up alongside us. And two guys say, "You're going to have to come with us," to me and Murray, who was our staff writer at the time. I said, "Oh, what's up?" And he said, "Well, we're going to have to check you in. We need to scan your passport." So we had to get in this minibus and be driven over to passport control to make sure that we were okay to enter the country. tree. And then they said to us, well, we're knocking off now. You're going to have to just go through that gate over there. So when we got the Mercedes up and running again, which is about 2 hours later, Portsmouth had basically shut for the night. And we just had to leave on this through a back gate to go home.
Oh, my word.
The moral of the story is make sure your car is fit and healthy before you take it abroad.
I do think that is written somewhere within the feature.
Absolutely,
European coverage, yeah. But no, I think I've not had too many sort of abroad motoring maladies. We've heard sort of the odd thing go wrong here or there with cars. I know that with hire cars on family holidays, we've put them through all sorts of ringers, including thrashing small Nissan micro-based saloons across sort of the South Africa was certainly a childhood joyous memory of mine, including because my uncle has sort of very much the mentality of don't be gentle, it's a rental, and trying to keep pace with him down a number of gravel tracks across South Africa, bouncing around in the back seat of one of those as a child was quite fun, right up to the point where that we all got speeding tickets and handing the car back to the rental company in Cape Town with it just sort of a completely different colour, sort of going, I'm sure that'll wash off. Or doing the same thing with a hire car in Croatia and quickly wiping it down with a pair of loose underpants so it didn't look too shabby when we dropped it off. Because we knew that the hire car company we're dropping off at was one of the smaller ones, so someone was almost certainly going to see us dropping it off and would know that the car was in a filthy condition. So we just knew that we had to sort of buff most of the dust off of it from the number of gravel tracks we'd taken it down. So I'm going, they won't notice. What do we do with the pants? I don't know, bin them. So that was, yeah, I think I've had far more pleasant motoring abroad stories that I've had sort of problematic ones, apart from accidentally driving down the tram tracks late at night in Le Mans with James the other year, which yeah. was yeah
brief moment hopefully not with, with, and there was no tram coming the other way.
No, thankfully
we noticed before any trams came into the area. Yeah,
well, we were cruising along quite happily enjoying the city sights, and then we turned. Sat-nav told us to turn right, but you know what sat-nav's like. Sometimes they don't catch up or they're a little bit. And so you turn right when maybe, you know, it's not quite accurate. And then I said to Jesse, are we on tram tracks? He goes, I believe we are. And we're like, should we veer off? And then we had to kind of veer over some like a bit of pedestrianized area just to get back on the road. But it was yeah. better that than come head with the tram. I'm sure most of you listening would have seen those videos of vehicle meeting trams, and they never end well for the vehicle.
No, the trams never swerve out of the way.
No, they don't have the opportunity to jink left. Before we wrap up then, if you could take a classic on a dream road trip, where would you go and what would you take?
You go ahead, David. What would you do first?
For me, I would be taking a TVR, and I would take it. Well, I'd take it anywhere in Europe. I suppose I'd take it to the Alps, but something like a TVR Griffith or a Chimera would be absolutely glorious. Just hearing that wonderful V8 waffle kind of reverberating off the sides of the valleys would be perfect.
I would take I think I'd either take a Ford Mustang or across America. Not necessarily Route 66, but just I'd love to go through various states of America. I think Route 66 would be fantastic, but I think it's been done so many times. So I'd love to kind of drive through kind of Oklahoma, Texas, and, you know, kind of go to Nashville and just enjoy America in a proper American classic. How about you, Jesse?
I see. That's sort of treading on the toes of what I had written down in my notes, which was the Bandit Run, which is Texas to Texarkana and back again, sort of all the way across sort of the Southern Panhandle, and do it in a proper Trans Am. I've just, oddly enough, had a ping in my inbox of eBay going, item ends soon, countdown has begun. It's a 79 Trans Am. It's a bit of a project car, but it's at £3,850. And I'm like, ooh, I don't have the money for it. Both of my cars existing are broken, so I don't need another project car. But just shy of $4,000 for a Trans Am in that colour as well, proper sort of gold on black. I'm like, ooh.
Lovely. Yeah, proper smoky in the Bandit colours.
Yeah, that got me thinking about the Bandit Run again.
Yeah, well, just tell you what, given that it's both something that we want to do, clearly I'm not suggesting we buy a car together, but it's clearly something we want to do. Maybe we could be, you know, the Dukes of Hazzard.
Ooh,
not literally the Dukes of Hazzard, but I'm just thinking of my way of putting two of us in an American car together.
I was going to say 2027 will be the next anniversary for Smokey and the Bandit, so we'll start planning ahead, scrimping and saving the classic car weekly pennies, and we're going to head out and pick up a Trans Am and do the run.
Just put it on expenses.
Have we got listeners out that way? I haven't even checked if we've got listeners out there. Where's all my data? We do have listeners in the southern states of America. We've got listeners in Alabama, Georgia, and Florida. So I'm sure we could tie it in with sort of hosting a local car show for local classic car weekly enthusiasts in that part of the world.
There you go. If you live in the southern states and you want to put us up, please do drop us a message.
Yeah.
If you want to lend us a car, maybe American listeners have got a Trans Am or something similar that they'd be thrilled to lend us for
60s, 70s, V8 engine, that sort of thing. If you've got one that you'd be happy to lend us to do a tour of the southern states, we'd be more than happy to oblige and come over. We'll bring a copy of the paper with us for good measure.
I believe there are classic kind of American classic hire car companies out there. I don't know how many there are, but I believe there are, that you can do that out there.
Oh, there's
worth investigating.
Well, again, something to put on expenses. I'm sure they'll let that one slide. Anyway, that's all we've got time for on this week's episode. We've got a busy week still ahead of us as we sort of head into production of the next issue. I can't even remember what we've got coming up in the next issue. Checks notes. That's it. We're working on our 5th of February issue. So the E-Type's final years, as we're looking back when the last Series 3 was registered. Plus the usual buying guides, keepers, and events pages as well. So there's plenty still to go into this one, actually. I'm looking forward to it. There's some good bits and pieces to look forward to. So we'll crack on with that, and we'll leave you to enjoy this week's issue of Classic Car Weekly, and be back in about 7 days' time. David and James, thank you very much.
Well, a pleasure as always.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thanks, guys.
And we'll be back with more Classic Car Weekly in about a week's time.